Hi guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have taken time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out with us today. We're really grateful for you tuning in, and if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you've subscribed so that you never miss an episode, but if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you are listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy or ATA membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the Animal Training Academy website. Some of the ingredients of the membership include forums with hundreds of training videos and projects where together the community helps problem solve different training situations. We have the private Facebook group to share animal training successes, member updates, and relevant content. On top of this, we have WhatsApp chat groups. And we also connect live twice a month in members-only live web classes where we dive even deeper into the topics you will learn about here today. All previous web class replays are additionally stored for you to watch at your own convenience, and the content area has been referred to as Netflix for behavior nerds. To find out more about membership and how you can join the community and carry on the conversation, visit www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu. But we will get started on today's episode, where we're going to be talking to one Morten Egtvedt. Norwegian dog trainer Morten and his wife Cecilia have written 3 best-selling books about clicker training. They have also published the Nordic dog magazine Canis for exactly 20 years this winter. They are owners of Canis Clicker Training Academy, the leading clicker training dog school in the Nordic countries. They've personally trained more than 200 new clicker training instructors in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland since 2003 through their now famous clicker instructor course. Morten has trained dogs mostly for high-level obedience and working dog competitions. He has also trained dogs for search and rescue and for military service for many years. He is a trained biologist with a degree in ethology, but he's always been much more interested in applied behavior analysis than ethology when it comes to practical dog training. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Morten to the show today. Morten, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me, Ryan. It's an honor.
It's an honor to have you on the show today, Morten, and we're really appreciative of you taking time out of your busy schedule to come and hang out with us.
No problem. It's always fun to talk about dog training.
Yeah, and my journey sounds quite similar to yours. I've got a degree in ethology as well, but I'm way more interested in applied behavior analysis.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Kindred spirits. Morten, could you please, to start us off, take us back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and tell us about some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Well, I got my first dog when I was 16. And I think the first 2 years I trained it kind of traditionally with mostly positive reinforcement, but also some corrections. But actually, I think I discovered when the dog was like 3 years or so that positive training worked so much better. So, and I think that first dog was 4 or 5 years when I discovered clicker training for the first time. And then, of course, everything changed. But I trained that first dog to a quite high level with kind of old school dog training. And then he was sort of a crossover clicker training dog the last 2 years of his life. So when I got my first dog, it went kind of quickly. I think he was... when he was 2 years old, he was already certified as a search and rescue dog. And I think we started in the national championship for working dogs for the first time when he was 3 years old. I was 19 then. So it went rather quickly. And that's kind of typical for me when when I find an interest, I really just dive into it and try to learn everything there is to learn about it. And so when I first discovered clicker training, I really dived into that too. And it's kind of amazing how quickly I learned it, really, looking back. So
bring us up to speed now. You've been operating Canis for 20 years?
Yeah, well, we started Canis in 1998. And at that point, we had clicker trained our dogs for 3 years, about 3 years. And we were kind of really passionate about that new technology. And we really wanted the rest of the world to know about it, because back then, at least in Norway, almost no one knew about clicker training. So that, of course, made it very exciting to go out and teach it and offer courses in clicker training for dog owners when no one has heard about the clicker before. So that was a really fun time. And so we had a very steep learning curve.
And when you're telling this part of your journey, you're saying we. So you're referring to Cecilia. So whereabouts did Cecilia come in?
We are kind of like one person, so except when we are arguing. But we agree on most things in dog training.
And so where did you guys originally meet each other?
Well, we actually met doing search and rescue training. So
this is when you're about 19?
I think she was probably 19, 20. I was 1 year older. So that's also a good story, but I don't think that's the topic for tonight.
Has it got to do with dog training? You obviously try dog training.
Well, it is a fun story, because she came to my city to study, and so I met her when she on a search and rescue dog training for the first time. And interestingly enough, her dog was actually, that dog had the same father as my dog. So that's a lot of it's a fun story.
So completely coincidence.
Yeah.
And that kind of pulled you together.
Well, I like to think that it was more than that. But anyway, I'm sure it didn't touch.
It's kind of like fate, though. I mean, what are the odds? Yeah. What are the chances?
Yeah, exactly. So, I think I was more curious about clicker training in the beginning than Cecilia was, because we were kind of both traditional trainers, and she's probably a little bit more skeptic than me. I'm kind of curious and open when it comes new things to learn about, but she was kind of hesitant in the beginning, but it took a few months and then she was on board, and then she caught on very quickly, and she's a really good trainer.
And so the difference was at that time between what you guys were doing before clicker training and before you learned about positive reinforcement, what you were doing in the search and rescue scene?
Yeah, when we also trained obedience, and it was ordinary old school dog training. A lot of positive reinforcement, but also a lot of corrections when the dog did something wrong. And we really didn't know what we were doing. So we did what the other people were doing, and we tried the best we could. So it was trial and learning and reading books and picking up what made sense. And it's a very interesting time. So I don't think I would have wanted to be without that experience. It's kind of interesting when nowadays clicker training is often the first kinds of training and new dog owners is introduced to. And in some way, he misses a lot of, let's call it, interesting experience. Because you see the difference between that old style of training and clicker training. You see the differences so clearly when you have been on both sides of the fence.
And how did everyone else in your circle of friends and trainer colleagues at the time take this change? Did they want to come with you, or was there resistance?
Oh, it's a long story of resistance. But the good thing is that neither me or Cecilia, we have never really cared much about what other people think. So that has really been an advantage. So it's kind of been a fun challenge, really.
That's interesting. I want to talk about that a little bit. So do you think the fact that you haven't cared what other people think has helped you become successful? And I ask this because, Morten, there's always a lot of pressure for people to do what they're told. Mm. And you've obviously gone, well, I can see that there's a better way. What the dog's telling me is more important than what other people are saying.
Yeah.
How important do you think that was to Canis's success and your guys' success?
I don't know, but I really think what was really useful for me in the beginning when I started to clicky train my own dogs and started to teach other people about clicky training is that I had already achieved really good results with my dog. So, and it's really hard to argue when I have the dog in front of me and he can show all those great behaviors. It's very hard to argue with that. So I really didn't have to care much about what other people were saying, if that makes sense. So I think it would be much harder if I was a completely new dog trainer trying to start out with clicker training. Then I would have been much more sensitive to criticism and so on. But I already knew that I could train dogs, so it wasn't really a problem.
Okay, cool. I think that's helpful for people that might want to understand the way you think with regards to being in potential social pressure.
Yeah, and also it's I guess I have some kind of interesting personality because I'm what they call a mismatcher. So I'm very good at finding mistakes or differences. So I mean, if I can see that I have something that is different than how things are already being done, that is very, very reinforcing for me to do. So in a way, clicker training was much more interesting 20 years ago than today for me. But that's a weakness and a strength in my personality. I can't excuse it really, but it's kind of interesting.
I like that. So does that involve you being comfortable asking the hard questions and challenging people's views, would you say? Or
oh, yeah, I'm sure I've been a pain in the ass for a lot of people growing up. I hope I'm a little bit more mature nowadays, but looking back, I can see that I must have been very irritating for a lot of people. But I was young and passionate about dog training and clicker training. So,
and you wouldn't potentially be where you are today if you hadn't.
No, well, I couldn't done otherwise. I mean, that's something that I know now that you can't really do anything else than what your environment is selecting for you, really. So that's a nice excuse to have.
Well said. And so this position you have to be Morten, over the last 20 years has evolved you into a trainer today. Would you say that has a your kind of own approach to clicker training and dog training?
Yeah. I think our approach is kind of a little bit different from a lot of other clicker trainers. I think both me and Cecilia, we have kind of listened. Of course, we have trained together with a lot of other good trainers, but I don't think we have kind of listened most to what we have done ourselves and seen how that works. So I think what was really useful to both me and Cecilia was that we knew about behavior analysis before we discovered clicker training, because we have both studied psychology at the university. So when we first read about clicker training, it just connected all the dots for us. And we already knew about these learning principles. So it was kind of everything opened up, and we could see everything so clearly.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I feel some people start training and then learn about applied behavior analysis and then say that for them everything opens up. But you kind of went the other way around.
Yeah, and even though clicker training is building on applied behavior analysis, it's the same, but it's not the same. I have met brilliant behavior analysts, but they don't know really about practical dog training, and they really can't connect the dots, even though they know all those theoretical principles. And then on the other hand, you have brilliant practical dog trainers who do everything correctly, but they are not necessarily aware of the underlying principles. I think it was important for us that we already were kind of fluent in all the basic principles of behavior analysis before we learned about clicker training.
So it's rare, would you say? What's your input there to find people that have both of those pieces of the puzzle?
It was very, very rare 20 years ago. I think it's becoming more and more... I think that there are more and more good trainers nowadays. I think for the last 5 years, I'm kind of amazed how good people are in how good their knowledge are about behavior analysis, because I think the first 10 years, people tried to do clicker training and they did what they read about, they did what they were told, but they didn't really understand the underlying principles. But nowadays, I think much because of internet, Clicker Expo has been important. As I think people are much more aware now that the connection between clicker training and applied behavior analysis. So that's interesting.
And we're going to talk about your approach to dog training more. We've got a couple of topics that we're really going to dive into, but just want to mention something there. You said Clicker Expo, and you've kind of, and something we're going to talk about is your approach to dog training, which is potentially different than American in your mind. Is that correct? However, you've still traveled to the States and you've been a big part of Clicker Expo, haven't you?
Yeah, it was a long time since we lectured at Clicker Training, Clicker Expo the first time. I think that's 10 or 12 years ago. It was one of the first few years. Yeah, I don't remember anyway. But clicker training is clicker training, but also clicker training can be, there can be a lot of different styles within clicker training. And what we found when we were teaching in US the first years was that many people were kind of shocked how our dogs behaved, because the core of clicker training for me is what we can call voluntary behaviors. I want my dog to offer behavior while I'm just standing there clicking, reinforcing, and then I want the dog to offer that behavior again and again and again and again and again. And I do not want to cue the dog or help the dog with my body language or so on. I want the dog to offer the behavior voluntary and as independent of me as possible. That's really the core of clicker training for me. And this was when I read Karen Pryor's book, I think it was A Dog and a Dolphin. That was the first clicker training book I read. Must have been 20 years ago now. And she wrote, first get the behavior and let the dog repeat offering that behavior time after time, and then add the cue. When I read that, it just I could hear angels singing or something. I think it was so brilliant. Yeah, something like that. I never became the same person again. Wow. So it's just brilliant that you can teach the behavior first and then start adding the cue in the background, just adding the verbal cue in the background and then kind of moving the cue a little bit earlier and then starting to only reinforce the behavior when you have given the cue first and so on. I think that was brilliant. And so it was kind of surprising to come to US and see that they did not really put that much emphasis on voluntary behaviors as I thought was the meaning of clicky training. So that was interesting, because what I'm seeing as at least the first years we went to US, we saw that the American style of clicky training was very much lure the dog with the treat and then click. And then they didn't really fade the lure. They just kind of made it smaller and then transformed that lure into a visible cue, like a hand signal. And when you go from luring the behavior with the treat and then transforming that movement into a hand signal, there is really no voluntary behavior there at any point. The dog is only following your lead all the way. And of course, that's positive dog training, and it's just not what I'm interested in. I'm not hearing any angels singing when I see that kind of training.
I love it.
I really want a dog who is kind of throwing behaviors at me. I want it to be... if it's difficult to stop the dog from throwing behaviors at me, I'm a happy man. That's what I want. And because, I mean, the objective for animal training for me is to train fluent behaviors. That's the goal. I mean, my interest was in high level competition training. So my goal is to train really solid, fluent precision behaviors, and teaching the dog to offer voluntary behaviors is the best way to teach a fluent behavior. Because if the dog can learn to repeat that behavior voluntarily, like 15 to 20 times in 60 seconds, then you have a really solid behavior. And it's a very big difference between a behavior the dog can offer like 6-7 times a minute and the same behavior when the dog can offer it like 15 to 20 times a minute. It's really not the same behavior anymore. So when you have a fluent behavior, that behavior has changed completely, and it's that, and now I can really use that behavior for something useful. I have really no use for a behavior if the dog can only do it like do a sit 6 times a minute. That's not good enough. That behavior will break down very soon if I start to combine it with other behaviors or changing up the situations and so on. So fluency is really, really key. And if you start training the behavior voluntarily, get the fluency level up to like 15, 20 times for short behaviors, and then start adding the cue. It's so simple to add a solid verbal cue that is very much independent of anything else than actually the verbal cue and just me being around. So, and you don't get that same attitude when you are luring the dog all the time. It's just not the same. It's not the same result. So I'm very passionate about that.
Yeah. Okay. So going back to the start, you said you don't want to be offering any cues, and you're talking about when shaping the behavior, you're going to add that cue later.
Yeah. So let's say the behavior is, let's take a simple behavior as down. Then the first step for me would be to, the goal would be to teach the dog to offer the down behavior in, let's say, 18 times in 60 seconds when I'm just standing quietly in front of the dog. That's the goal. if you want to lure the dog in the beginning, that's fine. But what I'm not so fond of is if you never remove that lure at all. So I think it's fine if you have to lure the down and then you fade the lure, and then you can stand quietly and the dog is offering the behavior voluntarily. That's fine. You don't necessarily have to start with free shaping, even though I prefer that and I usually do that. But I think the most important thing is that you have this phase in the training where the dog is literally throwing the behavior at you, and you really build that fluency before you add the cue and get it under stimulus control. I think that's a really important.
So you said free shaping then, and for you, the definition of voluntary behavior is, as you're standing there, would you say completely like not moving, not saying anything, and just waiting for that animal to throw their behavior at you?
Well, I'm not really. You can start training a behavior in many different ways. You can lure it. You can use targeting. You can free shape it, just standing there. There are a lot of different solutions. But whatever technique you are using, my goal would be to be able to just stand there quietly, and the dog offer the behavior independently of my movements in 15 to 16, 20 times a minute. And then I can start adding the cue.
And
of course, the reason this is important to me is that at least in the Nordic countries, you need a solid verbal cue in competitions. So if you have trained a behavior that is as independent of the handler as possible, it's so much easier to add a reliable cue to the behavior. But if you have a behavior that has kind of always been a little bit dependent on how you are moving your hand, how you are looking at the dog, that you are kind of bending towards the dog and so on, then you never really learn the dog a clean verbal cue. And that's always my goal, to have a very clean verbal cue, so the dog is responding to the verbal cue and is as independent of me as possible. Of course, I'm the part of the picture usually, but it's a big difference just to stand up straight and to do all those things with your hands to get the behavior.
So if you're standing there straight and trying not to move and trying to get the free shape and get the dog to throw those behaviors out, does your still body language and your lack of vocalization, et cetera, lack of hand movements, become an antecedent that says to the dog, try stuff?
Yeah, that's right. But there's an important difference is that I want to teach the dog to offer the behavior while I'm doing things that I'm allowed to do in the competition ring. And in the competition ring, I'm allowed to to stand straight with my arms down, and I'm allowed to walk and so on, but I'm not allowed to bend over the dog or stare at it or do things with my hands. So that's an important difference. So I want to teach a dog to offer the behavior while I'm doing things I'm allowed to do in competitions. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. And you mentioned that then you want to get the dog up to fluency. And fluency for you means that within the space of 60 seconds, the dog's doing it a set amount of times?
Yeah, for short behaviors like sit, down, heel, so on, usually 15 to 20 times a minute is a good fluency level. And for other behaviors, it's a little bit different. But the main point is that when the dog offers the behavior, you click into it, then the dog offers it again as soon as possible. So that's what fluency is really. And For me, the reason I'm a clicker trainer is that I think it's the best way to build fluent behaviors. Because a clicker training is by nature a kind of a fluency-based technology, where the way we usually clicker train is the dog offer the behavior, we click it, the dog does it again and again and again and again, until we have built a good enough fluency. And then we can start adding the cue and start using that behavior in other contexts. But first we build fluency through repetition, lots of repetitions.
And
I think most dog trainers underestimate how many repetitions you really need to build a really solid fluent behavior. And it's so important because, I mean, if the dog can offer 20 downs a minute, if I can get to that level, that my dog will never, ever forget that behavior. I can stop training it for like 8 years and the dog will still remember it. It's like learning to ride a bike. When you have achieved real fluency, that behavior will always be there as long as the dog's alive. But when you only have a fluency level of like 6-7 a minute, then that behavior will be gone next month if you don't continue to train it. And the problem for many obedience trainers is that they start adding the cue much too early, and they start using behaviors in chains when those behaviors aren't really fluent enough. And the result, of course, is that next week that chain breaks down because the behavior isn't fluent enough. So fluency, that's really the answer to anything. If one of my students has a problem with an obedience exercise, I know what basic skills the dog needs to be able to perform that exercise. It may be 5 or 6 different basic skills in that obedience exercise. And if the student says that she has a problem with that exercise, then I usually can first find the weak part of the chain. And then I can ask, what is your fluency level on that behavior? And it's always too low. So then the solution is to increase the fluency on that behavior. And then when you put it back into the chain, it works. So for me, really, dog training is it's very predictable. It's almost like math. If you have the right fluency level, then that obedience exercise will be reliable. And if you don't have it, then you will have trouble next week or next month or next year. That's just the way it is. So
when you're asking your student or client what the fluency level is, the answer you're looking for is how often that animal will repeat that behavior uncued in a 60-second period? Or does it matter if it's cued or not?
Well, I would like to see both. First of all, I would like to see the affluent voluntary behavior. And if I see that, okay, the fluency level is good enough, then the next step is to get a reliable cue on that behavior. And then I would very much like to see like the 10 repetitions in a row on cue, but that's the next step. So and that's another thing. When people have a problem with a cue, it's not the cue that's the problem usually. The problem is usually that underlying behavior is not good enough. It's not fluent enough. So when I'm fixing up a cue who's kind of broken, I always go back to teaching the dog to offer the behavior voluntarily. I'm building that up to a good enough fluency level. And then I start adding the cue again. And then the cue is working because it wasn't really the cue that was the problem in the first place. The problem was that the fluency wasn't there. And also it's a big advantage to have that voluntary fluent behavior before you start adding the cue, because if you start adding the cue when you only have like, let's say, 6 or 7 repetitions in 60 seconds, then the dog will do a lot of mistakes when you give it the cue. And then you will start kind of diluting the cue. You will give the cue, but the dog will do a lot of mistakes. And that does not give you a reliable cue. But when you have this really fluent voluntary behavior first, and when you then start adding the cue, it's very easy to be like 95 to 100% success rate because the dog knows the behavior.
So the overriding message is for us to, and us being people listening to this podcast, to get the fluency and do more repetitions and add the cue after we've got high fluency without the cue.
Yeah, that's very important.
And the method of free shaping. So we're standing there, there's the animal's throwing the behavior at us versus luring the dog or animal, whatever we're training into that behavior.
And just let me say that it's fine to start with luring, but just fade that lure as soon as possible and then get to what looks like free shaping.
Because if you don't, there's going to be different learning happening, would you say?
Yeah. If you start adding a verbal cue while you are still using your hands, that visual cue will kind of block that verbal cue. So the results will be very different.
Have you got any examples that you can think of?
Yeah, simple example like down again. If the dog is still dependent on you moving your hand downwards, and you start adding the verbal down cue while you're still using your hand, you tend not to get that really clean verbal cue. And people say that my plan is to kind of fade the visual cue later. But in my experience, they usually never do it. and I know that in US, you are allowed to use more visual cues in competitions than you are in Norway. So that's a difference. So that's, I guess, one thing that explains also that there's a little bit of difference in training styles. But for me, at least, it's important that the dog responds to my verbal cue, even when he can't see my body or see my movements.
And would you say that,
and just teaching the dog to offer the behavior as independent as possible of you as a trainer, that just take care of all those problems.
And would you say that in your experience, dogs who have been mostly taught via free shaping versus taught by luring, what's the difference? Yes.
I can see the difference in the first 15 seconds. It's so easy to see the difference because generally when the dog is really haven't learned to offer voluntary behaviors, it's always the dog trainer who is starting the behavior by some kind of movement. And it's not really the dog who is in control. It's always the handler who takes the initiative by doing some kind of movement. And I always want my dog to tell me when I'm going to start training. So if I'm training, for example, let's say healing, then what I would do is just stand still in front of the dog and then just leave it to the dog to decide when he's ready to start working. And the way he tells me is that he immediately offers heel position, and when he sits in heel position, he stares at me. He really stares at me, like telling me to come on, daddy, start walking. Come on, start walking. And when he looks at me that way, okay, then I can start healing. So it's the dog who is kind of gets me going, not the other way around. And it's so much more to train obedience with that kind of dog. The dog is driving you, and not the other way around. So that's the attitude I want in an obedience dog.
And when you wrote down a couple of things for us to discuss today with regards to your approach to dog training, you wrote down basic skills. Is this stuff falling into your category of basic skills, that building that eye contact, et cetera, and just having mindset of fluency?
Yeah. When I start training a new puppy for obedience or working dog competitions or whatever, I have this list of basic skills that I know I need to teach him if he should be able to do those advanced obedience exercises later. And I know the fluency level of every one of those basic skills. I think from the Norwegian competitions, we have defined like 19 different basic skills. Let's say 19 categories. And within each category, there are like 4, 5, 6 variations of that behavior. So sit could be one basic skill. But a dog needs to learn to sit in front of me. He must learn to sit while I'm moving. He must learn to sit from laying down, and so on. So there's a lot of, there's some different variations of each behavior. But there are about 19 big behaviors with some variations. And I need every one of those basic skills fluent. And when I have that, it's so much fun to train that dog. And it's so simple to develop all those advanced obedience exercises because all the building blocks are there. And when I'm teaching all those basic skills during the first year I have that dog, the dog is not only learning the behaviors, he also learns a lot of, let's say, concepts. He learns that he has to start behaviors himself. He can't just wait for me to do something. The dog learns that he has to do something himself to get me to click or to start some kind of activity. And he also learns that when I click a behavior, that becomes kind of a cue to offer that same behavior again and again and again until I eventually change the rules and start clicking another behavior. And that's also very useful when you are building fluency. So you get this very, very funny clicker training attitude when you are working with those voluntary basic skills that first year. And many people say that free shaping is hard. But the reason it's hard is that you have to build the dog's free shaping skills piece by piece. You start by very simple behaviors, and then you take a little more difficult behavior, and then you build on that. And when you have free shaped like the first 6, 7 behaviors, the next 6 or 7 behaviors are so much easier to free shape because the dog is starting to get some, let's say, understanding of the concepts of how the rules of the games of the game works.
And getting the
And of course, if you always lure the dog and it's always you who take the initiative when the dog is supposed to do something, then your dog will learn that set of rules. And it will give a very different result. So for me, clicker training, that's what clicker training is about for me. I want to see a dog who is really offering behaviors as independent of the dog trainer as possible. The dog trainer, of course, has to be there. He has to be part of the picture. But it's a long way from just being around the dog and doing all those things with your hands and body. And also when you are helping your dog a lot, you will also reinforce a lot of wrong behaviors because most people, when do you help your dog? Well, it's usually when the dog is doing nothing. That's when you present all those lures or body movements. You move your legs, you do something with your hands and so on. And then you reinforce the dog for just standing there and waiting. And when you do that for a year, that's not a clicker trained dog in my book, because that dog is way too passive. I'm going to get a lot of hate mail now.
I hope not.
It's a good thing I don't care.
I hope that, and my assumption would be this is really beneficial for everyone listening to it.
Yeah, I mean it well, because it's such a big difference between leave the work to the dog. Your job is to mark the behaviors and find the right criteria. And please, as much as possible, reinforce the dog for doing things on its own initiative. And please do not reinforce the dog for just standing there passive, doing nothing. It's so important. Unless you want the dog who is very passive. Because a lot of pet dog owners, that's what they want. They want a passive dog who doesn't give them any trouble. And so in some ways, I guess that could be kind of convenient. Because I guess for some pet dog owners, it can be kind of scary to see a dog who is very active and offering behaviors all the time. Because how can I control this? He's just throwing behaviors at me all the time. But that is, of course, only the first step of the training. And one of a very important voluntary behavior that you want in your dog is the behavior of waiting or just freezing in a position. That's also a voluntary behavior. So all voluntary behavior do not have to be movement. It's also important to teach the dog to voluntarily freeze in a position. So you have to find a balance. But I think that there's an interesting difference there. I think some positive trainers, their focus is on making the dog very calm, just removing all the stress and so on. Because if there are no arousal there, then the dog is behaving. And that's convenient, but it's not very interesting. So what I want is a very active dog, but a very active dog with skills. I want a very active dog with a lot of fluent behaviors. I want a dog who knows how to do stuff, because then my dog can be very active, very alive, but I have all those great fluent behaviors, so I still have an obedient dog. I think that's an interesting difference also. And I don't know if that makes sense.
It all makes sense. But, I've got a million questions. I just want to jump to one of the topics you talked about there, which was teaching a dog a freeze. Now, do you teach frozen positions separately, or do you teach the dog
to freeze in sit position, in heel position, in standing position? All those are basic skills that is just as important as sitting down, laying down, running towards me, grabbing the dumbbell, all those active movements. And just freezing in a position is just one more behavior. And you can free shape, it's very easy to free shape that behavior, because most dogs offer the first second of freeze for free, and then you just build from there.
And do you train, and the reason I'm asking this is because we're talking about it in the ATA, Animal yeah. Training Academy community the other day, so I'm interested. Do you train a freeze cue ever? So it doesn't matter what position you're in, if I say freeze, you just immediately stop? Or do you train all those behaviors separately?
That's a very good question. The first step for me is to teach the dog to freeze voluntarily. Ideally, I do not want to use any stay signals, no hand signals, no nothing. I just want the dog to offer a freeze, and then I click and reinforce that and gradually increases the time up to, let's say, 10 seconds for a start. And when the dog really starts to offer that freeze behavior, then I can start adding the stay cue if I want to do that. So it's really exactly the same as every other active behavior. And the advantage of teaching it as independent of my movement as possible is that when I add that verbal stay cue, that verbal stay cue actually works. I do not have to use my hands in addition to that verbal stay cue. So the freeze behavior is really no different from every other active basic skill in my book, if that makes sense.
It does. And I just want to additionally build upon something you said, because you have written down something similar in the topics you were thinking about covering today, you thought would be beneficial to cover today. And that topic was how to market clicker training to dog owners. And you said potentially dog owners might want a different type of dog. What's your input there? And how do you go about marketing clicker training to dog owners? And when you say this, are you talking about your run-of-the-mill everyday dog owner or dog owners that are already interested in training their dogs more?
Yeah, well, I think I would go about it a little different if it was a pet dog owner and a dog owner who was training for competitions or search and rescue or whatever. But I guess what I had in mind when I brought up that topic, I think was something a little bit different. It's a little bit scary to go into this territory if I don't know how much time we have, and I'm not formulating myself as precise in English as I sometimes want to. But I think when I started clicker training 20 years ago, I think it was very important to teach people an alternative to correction-based training. So it was really important to teach people the difference between training with positive reinforcement and, let's say, correction-based training. So, and the first 10 years, then it was kind of, there were some polarization there between clicker trainers who were very, very good with their dogs and correction-based trainers who were mean to their dogs, you know. But I think nowadays, I think that a lot of clicker trainers nowadays also talk a lot about animal welfare as an important reason why they clicker train. And you still often see clicker trainers who are criticizing people who are using aversives in the training and so on. And I actually think it's important that we kind of try to not, this may sound a little strange, but I would kind of wish we didn't pay too much attention to the difference between positive reinforcement training and negative reinforcement based training. And maybe instead focus much more on how we as positive reinforcement-based trainers can really improve our technology. Because there are a lot of clicker trainers who, they are really good to their dogs, but they are not necessarily good trainers. That's two different things. Being kind to your dog and being a good trainer, it's not the same thing. And what I see a lot, especially in competition training, is that the best way to market positive dog training and clicker training, that is to show other trainers that your dog has really good fluent behaviors, high precision fluent behaviors. That's the best marketing you could wish for. And I would like us to get away from criticizing people who still use punishment and instead only focus on how can I improve my own clicker training. And maybe we should be a little more results-oriented than animal welfare-oriented. because I don't think there is any contradiction there. I mean, if you clicky train effectively, I mean, the animal welfare part is built into it, because when you are clicky training in a good way, the animal is in control. And of course, there are all, you can do high level things to improve the animal welfare even more. But I'm not sure that's the best selling point when you want to market clicky training to that other camp. And I've thought about this a lot lately, because it's kind of easy to see some similarities between politics, especially in US, where it's very polarized, you know, where on the one side you have very conservative, kind of dogmatic forces, and on the other side you have those very idealistic people who criticizes capitalism and all those. They have very good motives, but not always very good answers to how things should be done in practice. And I really do not want clicky training to end up in that situation, because as clicky trainers, we are also living in this, you know, social media echo chamber. And in our echo chamber, it's very easy for a certain kind of behavior to be reinforced, where we pay so much attention to being kind to the dogs and making life so nice and simple and convenient for our dogs. And it can be more and more extreme in that echo chamber. And I don't think that's a good way to market clicky training to that other camp. It may only increase the distance. So I think that what could... It's very easy to misunderstand this. But I think what I would like to see more of is that even though we are part of a group of people who think the same, and it's very important to have the support of people like that. But at the same time, it's important to step out of that bubble now and then, and because that's the only way you really can have an effect on the other side if you want them to learn about clicky training too. And maybe the best way to market clicky training is not to sell that most extreme variant of clicky training I think that if we are a little bit more results oriented and we focus on building precise behaviors, fluent behaviors, we're focusing on developing our skills in better timing, better criteria, reinforcing behavior better, and so on, and using all those scientific principles, I think it's much easier to kind of meet the other trainers sort of in the middle. These are very loose thoughts, and I did not really formulate this as precise as I wanted. Well, what is your impression from what I just said?
I think it sounds completely reasonable, rational, and it reminds me of something you said earlier, where when you were first starting, you let the dog's behavior, the results of the dog, speak for this new technology that you were using, clicker training. And yeah. I think it's going to be impossible for anyone to say and sit here in 2018 and look at what you've done with Canis and clicker training in your region and globally, and how many dogs' lives you've changed, and say that you haven't been successful at influencing positive change.
Yeah, and I don't think I ever have really put much emphasis on being kind to the dogs, and the reason is that the moment I start emphasizing that I'm so kind with my dogs, I also sort of imply that people who are not clicker training are not kind to their dogs. It follows from that assumption. So that's why I really do not want to focus much on that. I want to focus on things like timing, criteria, reinforcement, all those observable things, and really to some extent take the ethics a little bit out of it. And I can sleep very well doing that because I know that this way of training is really good for the dogs and for the people. I mean, so, and I think that just leads to a lot less polarization between the camps. And also I would like to see, for me, it's actually, it's more important to see clicky trainers improving their own skills than to see, let's say, traditional dog trainers moving over to our side. Because as soon as they see good clicky trained dogs, they will start to gravitate towards that, because that's just the way things works. And if we start talking too much about that you should be kind with your dogs and not punish it, then you only get counter control, and that's terrible shaping of other dog owners. So I think it's important that we as clicky trainers focus on ourselves and improving our own skills, and then people will follow.
I think that's sage advice, and I don't think anyone can argue with that logic. Hey, just looking at the time, and conscious that, and thank you as well, I should say, before I move on, very much for giving us such a deep and thoughtful description of how you think about this. I really look forward to listening back to this and thinking over this more now, as we are in February and we're about to release this podcast, but also over the coming years, and because we're all involved in this. I think most of the people that listen to this podcast are involved in this journey and helping to shape the future for dogs and all of our learners, all of our different species. So really appreciate your input. There was, just before we finish up, one other subject that you wrote about to me that you'd be interested in talking about today, and something that when we caught up for a Skype call a few weeks ago, you started telling me about it, and I'm actually really interested. So I want to just finish on this as our last topic of conversation. You are now heavily involved in teaching instructors, teaching other people to instruct clicker training, and you've got what you call a benchmarking system.
It's a teaching tool that me and Cecilia have developed during the last 3 years. And it's really just a way of thinking about the skill of clicker training, just to kind of try to break the big skill of clicker training. We are trying to break it down in smaller parts, so that it's easier for new instructors to know where to look when they want to improve their own training and their students' training. So what we have done basically is that we have kind of divided the art of clicker training into 8 broad categories. And these categories are timing, criteria, reinforcement, voluntary behaviors, stimulus control, training, and also something that we call training focus, and at last, mechanical skills. And all these 8 categories, we are talking about the dog trainer's behavior, not the dog, but the trainer's behavior. Because clicker training a dog, that is a behavior that you have to develop as a dog trainer. There's a lot of different behaviors you need to build fluency in. And if you take, for example, the first category of timing, that category, again, can be broken down into 6 or 7 trainer skills. I can just mention a few of them just to give people an idea. One obvious timing skill is the precision on your marker signal. So do you click precisely, or are you half a second late, for example? The next skill is, are you actually using the clicker, or are you using another marker which is not that precise as the clicker? Another skill, timing skill, is that When you click or use another marker, do you always reward after the marker? And in my book, that should be 100%. But timing is also even more than the clicker. The fourth timing skill is something I call, have to translate this. It's that you are precise in when you are starting some activity. An example would be if you are training the dog to hold the dumbbell. Let's say the dog is sitting in heel position, and the moment the dog is looking up at you, then you present the dumbbell right in front of the dog. That is kind of precise. What we see in new trainers is that the dog is looking at them for 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and then they present the dumbbell. That would be not very fluent on that skill. And then again, you have precision when it comes to using cues and so on. And also that you are not moving until after the click. That is also a timing skill. So there are several skills within the category of timing. And it is the same in every one of these 8 categories, that there are several concrete skills within that category. I think we have defined about 60 different skills all in all. So during our instructor course, our students learn what each of these skills look like on beginner level, on intermediate level, and on expert level. So for example, when you have the precision, the timing skill of clicking precisely, on beginner level, the way that skill looks is that the trainer will usually be from 0.5 to 2 seconds late on every click. Have you seen the same?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. And then when people are starting to get more experience and moving up to intermediate level, then most of the clicks will be precise enough. And with precise enough, I mean that you are reinforcing, you're not reinforcing the wrong behavior at least. And usually you are right on target. But you can still see a difference when you move up to the expert level. Because when I see a really skilled clicker training, a really skilled clicker trainer, then it's like he or she is clicking so precisely that I notice. I really notice that, wow, that was precise. That's really photo quality precision.
You can hear the angels in the background singing.
Yeah, yeah. I can feel the difference, but of course this is very objective. If you look at the training movie and you run it in slow motion, you can see the difference very clearly. So that's the way that this benchmarking system is built. There are 60 different skills, and we have tried to describe what does this skill looks like on beginner level, intermediate level, and expert level. Because when a new instructor knows the difference between, okay, this is what a beginner looks like on this skill, this is what an a little more advanced trend looks like, but this is where we want to go. We want to go to the expert level. Then it's much easier to know where to focus to improve your training. It makes it very concrete. So in our instructor training, we usually We do 1 week where we only focus on these different timing skills first. And that really changes people's training, even though they were actually really good already. But just focusing on this specific trainer skills and all the time having in the back of your mind what it looks like when an expert is doing it, that makes you move in that direction. And you also start paying attention when you are a little bit off target. Because a lot of clicker trainers, they don't really pay attention if they are clicking 0.3 seconds late. They don't pay attention to that as long as they get away with it. But just being a little bit more precise can make your training so much more efficient when you do that every day for several years. And it's the same thing with every trainer skill in all those other categories too. So it's been very helpful to have this benchmarking system. And I learned a lot while I was writing it. It took a very long time.
How long did it take?
I used at least a year before I had something that looked like what I have now. And of course, I keep improving it.
Sounds amazing. I want to see it.
Yeah. Oh, we should translate it to English. Yes. But I'm still kind of working on it, and I don't want to translate it before I'm really happy with it. So, but I think we're soon there. So,
and you said the last benchmarking element is you call training focus.
Yeah, it's the main idea is to have a plan for your training session. That's the big idea with training focus. And you can measure the degree of training focus by things like the time spent on the training field where the dog is not working, being reinforced, or is on a break. So if you're doing anything else than think, plan, do, we often call it dead time. And that's kind of the time where you are not really paying attention to the dog, but the dog is right there with you and he's paying attention to you and he's even maybe offering some behaviors. But because you don't have a plan and you are not paying attention to the dog, you are missing a lot of clickable moments. So that's one reason that you should, when you are actually training with your dog, you should always have, you should know what to do from start to finish as much as possible. Because if the dog from very young learns that when we are training together, I always have the possibility to earn reinforcement as long as I keep offering behaviors. It's a very big difference between that and a dog that, okay, maybe my trainer is training now, but maybe he's not paying attention to me. So maybe I should go over there and pay attention to something else instead. You get a very different attitude if you're not careful about your, let's say, training focus. So it's about planning your training. And I guess Eva and Emily, they talk a lot about this. Just using your rewards to transport your dog to the next starting point, so there is no dead time between the repetitions and so on. That really improves the efficiency of the training. And it also that you have good routines so the dog knows when it's on a break and when it's actually supposed to offer behavior. That's also part of this. Was that answering the question?
Very cool. And the problem is when you answer a question, it just generates about 20 more in my mind. But
yeah,
looking at,
we can talk next week.
Yeah, looking at the time, we should start to head towards the end. So we'll start to wrap up. But before we officially do, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, Morten, thank you so much for making time out of your evening. It's nearly midnight there where you are. We really appreciate you doing this.
Thank you.
And do you want to tell everyone, just before we do end, where they can go to find out more information about you and what you guys are up to?
Well, first of all, you must learn to read Norwegian, and then I'm sure you'll find me. No, I don't really have much to offer the English-speaking audience right now. I'm sorry. Me and Cecilia, we did a lot of travel before abroad, but we have two kids now and four horses, so we try to stay home as much as possible. And we mostly focus on the Nordic market now. What I'm doing basically these days is doing the instructor training. That's what I do basically these days. But the kids will grow up, and then maybe we can start traveling again.
Mm-hmm. And for people in your region, what's the website, just in case they want to go check it out? And I've been on your website. I just use the Google Translator function, and I can read it all in English.
If you search for my name or for Canis, I'm sure you find it.
Definitely. We do, of course, really appreciate all of you out there tuning in as well. So if you've enjoyed the episode, and if you are interested in carrying this conversation on even further about the most positive, least intrusive ways of influencing behavior, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with more like-minded, positive reinforcement based animal trainers from around the globe. Whether you're training or thinking about training dogs, cats, other pets, birds, zoo animals, implementing techniques within your vet clinic, the list goes on and on. Any area where behavior management is required, you'll love all the different ways you can join in. Forums, WhatsApp, private Facebook group, live members only web classes, and of course all of the content available in the members area. There is something there for absolutely everyone. We are looking forward to having you join our family. That's it for this episode, though. We will officially now wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. But for now, take care, polar bear. You'll hear from us again soon.